But I will. I there you go.
Hey, hey, we're recording.
We are. So Christina, good to see you.
Christina, welcome to the Look Back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What a kick. No, it's my pleasure. My pandemic podcast, I get to connect with all the folks I've done work with over the many years and just like refresh on our relationship and what's gone on and, you know, some memories, but also catching up on what's everybody doing. And I might need a new name because, you know, everybody wants to look forward. Enough looking back. Let's just keep
moving. You have to look back to inform where you're going. And it's so good to have a moment to talk about it, because what's interesting is, especially for those of us who have known each other for a long time in the industry, although we've been all in kind of consumer technology for many, many years, it's taken so many forms now. So it's really interesting where we started, and now technology is just everywhere.
Christina, we've gone from my software to the metaverse.
Crazy, right?
And for me, I get to be a sit back semi-observer while you've been in the cockpit. You've been, you know, basically running super fast, hard charging since I've known you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when you go way, way back, I was a music major and wanted to be a rock star.
There you go. I could see
and
that.
That didn't pan out, obviously.
But wait a second. Which part didn't pan out?
But what I love about, you know, kind of looking back through, at least with my career, is that I've always been in consumer technology, and just how that has changed of how, you know, back in the days when we were buying software products physically from a store and kind of navigating all of that, of what people could really use to make their lives better. And then when I moved, you know, through that career, you know, now in video games, I was like, oh, it's kind of the same, right? Video games and consumer technology, it's all software. It's all software. It's all going to get out to their, you know, to the consumer to enjoy. So it was a really perfect career transition for me, to be honest, because it was enough familiarity with how software is built and how, you know, developers work and the timelines that they need and that kind of stuff, but a whole bunch of new stuff around creativity and how people experience entertainment today. And so it was a great career transition because it had a lot of stuff that was really familiar, but it also had a lot of stuff that was really new and exciting.
Kind of interesting that you point that out. There's so many amazing shifts that have gone on. There's just the idea of going from disc to CD to digital, to fully digital, to next level digital. Plus the business models have changed so radically.
Yeah, and they are doing that now, still now, especially within video game world, which is interesting because I kind of already navigated that in my previous role as CEO of, you know, what was my software that then became Librium that got sold to a French public company through that time frame. We really navigated software going from physical sales in a store to digital. Right. And now we would never even think about buying a piece of productivity software on, you know, in a store, let alone even paying kind of a premium price for it, because now it's either included or it's a subscription or it's something else. It's just really shifted so much. Video games have really gone through a very similar transition that I'm getting to experience all again, which is, you know, how much of it is still selling physically versus how much is selling on a premium digitally, to how much is being sold free to play with transactions over time. It's all different. And now it's even going to be more different with subscription services such as Stadia or, you know, Game Pass with Xbox, or, you know, the different subscription services and cloud streaming services. It's all different.
Nothing stays the same. But let's go back for a second to my software. What, you had some amazing accomplishments as the as the productivity on the entry level side with some neat titles and just selling to, I love mentioning the names. Isn't it fun? Babbage's Software, etc. Join me if you will.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And by the way, GameStop.
Which exactly. So hopefully, I mean, that isn't that crazy that it was so long ago that that's how we all experienced and purchased our software. And
it's like prehistoric times at some point, doesn't it?
Definitely. Definitely. But you know what it did let you do, which we've lost a little bit, is it let you browse in a different way that we haven't solved for today. You know, physical representations of technology sometimes is necessary for people to kind of walk through and pick it up and look at it and say, oh, hey, okay, I understand what that does, versus, you know, have it was more of a passive experience than an intentional experience that we have today, where we have to like literally Google search for something that we want to look for. And then we're having to do research to find what we want to purchase, versus kind of walking the aisles and seeing what's out there in more of a passive way. So there's sometimes that I miss those days, because you could, it was a different way of selling too, because now we have to sell really to the consumer directly. Back in the day, we really had to sell to a buyer. You know, we had to convince the buyer that there was market demand for this title or things like that.
Take my title, put it on the shelf, put it on more shelves or more facings or.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Those days. We still do a lot. I mean, today, we still sell an enormous amount of product physically, video games.
Wow.
You know, still now.
Who are the dominant channels then?
So it would be your traditional consumer technology retailers. So we're still moving a lot of product through Best Buy, GameStop, and Walmart and Target and their global equivalents, you know, wherever, you in Germany, you're still shopping at MediaMarkt, and in France, there's still opportunity at Micromania. You know, there's stuff everywhere that you can still get physical. And we're actually seeing a lot of opportunity in what we're calling kind of transmedia. So, you know, we're taking a game that is, you know, primarily available digitally, but then we're putting merchandise in it and creating collector's editions and things like that, which is really interesting because the video game industry is so gigantic and the brands are so big and so personal for people, because they're, you know, they love the game that they're playing and they want more of it, that we're seeing huge demand in collector's editions. And so we're just selling some game with a blanket and some stickers. And
it sounds like an NFT may be heading this way.
Yeah, it's an interesting about NFTs is that we just haven't seen it kind of successfully make that jump to traditional video game world. And I think that people have tried it, but there's still a little bit of skepticism, and it's pretty polarizing from a market standpoint. And so at this stage, you know, I think it's super interesting and I love the space, but as far as it being kind of crossover to traditional video game world is not happening yet.
So you're probably dipping a little toe or doing a little exploration, but not spending a whole lot of time or money. Your time is super valuable. You're working on some great stuff, but tell me, when you look back on your time at My Software, which was just a fantastic company, great to work with, and everybody loved you guys. What are some of your favorite memories, professional memories?
Yeah.
From that time of.
When I started at My Software, I came over and one of the first big challenges that I had is that there wasn't enough new product. It was everything that My Software had kind of launched, they had already launched, and it was very catalog-y and like improving what had already been out there and things like that. And I was like, no, we need new stuff, new products, new consumer technology that people need. We have to come up with those. And the guy, one of the people in the production department said to me, there's no more software. Everybody has everything that they need from a technology perspective.
Right.
And I remember listening to that.
Is that guy's name Jim? No, just joke.
No, I don't know. I will not tell you his name. But I very specifically remember the feeling that it brought up in me at that time.
Yeah.
That of just hearing somebody say that and be very serious and believe it. And I thought, oh no, my job here is not necessarily to come up with a new product, but it's basically to inspire all of these people that there's new opportunities for them. You know, I mean, it really brought up something that was more about leadership within the company than it even was coming up with the next great idea for a product, because they were not in a space to even come up with an idea. And so I remember that to say that, you know, your key role as a leader and in managing a company is making sure that people feel inspired to come up with new ideas, because you don't have all the ideas. They have, you know, a ton of ideas. We just need to get it out of them. So it was a good lesson that I learned early in my career. And I was, you know, I was young at my software. And, and so managing almost everybody was older than me in that when I ran that company. And so it was really trying to figure out how to be inspiring and create space for people to be super creative and have great ideas that I got to learn there really early. So I remember that, you know, kind of an internal thing. And then I also remember some other things about kind of working, how to work with retailers in a way where we were addressing what they need, you know? And I think that that's something that happens in technology, is that you have this really great idea of a new tech product, but you haven't really figured out exactly the way that your customer can sell it through their channel. And that was one of the things during those days that we were, I remember learning to get really good at, is like figuring out with those retailers, how do you want to display product? How do you want your consumer to walk down that aisle and experience all of this stuff? And what can we do to make it better? And we were one of the first people to do things like, you know, put lots of foil and sparkly stuff on the outside of the box so that when people walk down, they would want to pick it up and see it, or put lots of flaps on the packaging so that they could read a lot about the product before they bought it. And so it was a really good experience early in my career to understand that your customer is not just your ultimate end user, but your customer is also the retailer or the channel partner that you're using. And so both, you know, kind of learning those things early was important for me and served well throughout the rest of my career.
Yeah, fantastic foundation from that perspective. And, you know, I think the people that do it well really do listen, right? Mm-hmm. That retailer who certainly has opinions, at least most of the ones I remember, they don't mind sharing them, but they are, if they're good, they're really doing what's in the best interest of the business, hence their customer, and giving you feedback, not to make their lives just simpler, but also to make everybody's lives more successful.
Absolutely. I talked to the sales, you know, the account management team, even here with in Video Game World, where they're talking, you know, with first parties such as Microsoft or Sony or Nintendo, or if they're talking to a retailer that's carrying a video game such as Walmart or GameStop, I'm like, you need to be asking them just as many questions as they're asking you. You know, they're going to ask you questions about the product, but you need to ask them questions about their business. What are they doing? What are they changing within their store? How can you be a better partner? And a lot of the, you know, a lot of that foundation happened back in those, my software and Librium days.
Yeah. Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about what's going on now. I know Maximum Games, was it an acquisition or a merger?
Yeah.
What do you call it? And what
it's
can
crazy,
you
crazy, right?
I mean, I did time this accidentally, coincidentally, with a lot of news going on around your business, but How's it going? What's happening? What can you share with us?
Yeah. So I started Maximum Games in, we shipped the first game in 2010. And so it's been, you know, 12, we're going on 12 years now, which is insane. Yeah. started it in my house. And it was really coming off of a time where, you know, it was the recession in 2007, 2008, 2009 during that time. And honestly, at the time, all of the jobs that were available, like the C-level positions, were all like failing software as a service companies and stuff that I was like, I just can't add any value here. I can't, it's not what I do. And I didn't love it. So we really started Maximum Games just out of necessity of starting. And it really wasn't even like, oh, I want to build a video game company. It was more of content that had already been launched in Europe that hadn't been launched in the US. And we're like, well, I can get that into Walmart and Target. So let's just do that. And so it started out more as like a broker deal in the beginning, but your personality always takes over. And so it just from there really turned into a business. And we found a really interesting niche within the video game industry where there was the, what had happened is technology was changing and Unity and Unreal and all of these different game development engines were making access for really, really great games to be created by smaller independent developers, right? So you didn't need to have the budget of a Ubisoft or an EA or a Square Enix. You know, you didn't need to have these really big budgets. A smaller group of people could create something pretty compelling. And what they were missing though, was the ability to successfully market and commercialize their game. And we found that we were a good match for that. We were a good match for taking really great creative independent content from smaller studios and bringing that to market with like kind of a AAA launch plan. And it really resonated and people loved it and people were really interested in having those services and all of the experience that I had from earlier in our career, of my career of bringing consumer technology product to market and understanding what the consumer needed to hear about and what they wanted to learn about and how they made those decisions really worked really well. And
right off the bat, like right from the beginning, with Maximum, you know, did you have a few little twists and turns?
Oh, so many mistakes, Keith. I can't even tell you how many mistakes, because the thing was we had to learn all about video game development at the same time. And what I was, although I was really good at like the sales and marketing and launch of a game, I was really bad at assessing quality of a game early in the process. Because I didn't know, like I only knew that from a productivity software standpoint and not from a video game standpoint. And so I, you know, we had invested, you know, tons of money in games that just never could make it to the finish line and never made it over, you know, never even made it to a launch status.
So you were using a little bit of gut instinct and saying, I have a feeling this will do well. And then you learned some hard lessons. But again, I asked the question because it's the instincts of an entrepreneur and a business person, seeds you've already sowed, let you figure it out and get it figured out quickly and turn it around.
For sure. And also I think that being an entrepreneur for all of this time, kind of running, I worked at Tech Data, which was my one job. I did way back in the day. Wow. It was, yeah. I used to work for Software Resource, which was like a small software developer in Northern California that got acquired by Tech Data. And I went over and worked for Tech Data. And that was my only experience working at like a corporate world. And I quit because they made me wear nylons. I was like, what is this? I am not doing this.
This is Tampa, Florida of all
places. I know. I'm like, first of all, it's not even healthy to wear nylons in Tampa. Right.
Oh my goodness.
And so, yeah. But
they're still around too, by the way, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They're still a really successful computer product. I mean, they're still a Fortune 500 company, I think. But what I learned is that I'm much better in an entrepreneurial environment because I need to be able to pivot quickly. And one of the things that I think has served me well through all of those years is that we have a phrase here that we use at, you know, within Maximum Games, is adapt or die. Yeah. And we have to adapt to what's changing in the industry or what's changing within our business, our particular company, really quickly. And so you have to be super comfortable failing, and you have to be super comfortable changing if it's not working. And that was one of the things that, you know, once you've had a couple companies, you feel a little bit more comfortable that positive failure can happen, you know, that you can make a mistake and you can say, oh, hey, this didn't work. We're going to try to, you know, we're going to try it this way. And the important thing though, and what I found is that it's really more important to instill that comfort in your team. And how do, just because you have that bias or, you know, way of life as an entrepreneur, that doesn't mean that everybody in your company has it. But for us to be successful, everybody in the company has to be comfortable changing, learning through failure. And it's your job as a leader to really create a space where they can. That's an important thing. So we say it all the time. We say adapt or die. If you talk to people here, they will say, oh my gosh, this company has been completely different every 18 months.
So much more. It's all been built or designed already. Right? Well, you're redefining so much. I have to ask you, so as a woman CEO who's actually seen a lot over the years, right? How are we doing? I mean, I know there's a lot of...
Yeah, not great.
Yeah.
Not great. I spent a lot of time talking to women in technology, women in video games. I'm on the board of two different female entrepreneur or female, you know, in games companies. I'm on the board of Women's Presidents Organization, which really is focused on the woman entrepreneur. I'm also on the board of Women in Games International, which is focused on women entering the workforce, particularly in the workforce of video game world. And it's hard. It's really difficult. It's been, there's a lot of work to do, both in, I would say, I'm going to talk specifically about technology and in video game world. So there's only two women who are CEOs of publicly listed companies in the video game industry, Debbie Bestwick of Team 17 and me, and that's it. And the video game industry is the largest entertainment industry in the world by a long shot, and yet there's only two. Now there's more women who are running privately held companies, and I'm not saying that there's not women, but you can almost name them, you know? And so it's really a challenge when you're looking at not just because you should have more women in leadership, but specifically in the video game industry, women not being in leadership means that our voice isn't being heard as far as what games are greenlit,
yes,
what games yes. are getting to market,
yes.
and how, and if we're not out there, other women who want to get into this industry don't have anybody to look to say, oh, hey, I want to do that. And I say this all the time. You can't be what you don't see.
I've heard
and,
that
name. That's one of the things that I think is what I'm trying to do within the industry, besides just, you know, bring games to market profitably.
It'd be super simple to go, okay, well, it's all the guys, young guys playing games that all of a sudden fall into the industry and go up, but that's too simplistic, right?
It's too simplistic. Yeah,
what's really happening? What is the barrier here that's creating this?
So I think that the barrier overall, I think is just one of inertia. It's not maliciousness. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think that we need to make a difference around that. It's not that people are blocking us from entering it into this industry. It's more that there's just not enough of women in the industry so that people to normalize it and to make it feel like, oh, this is an industry that I can enter. And so I think it's, you know, the responsibility of not only of people like me to make sure that I'm creating diverse and equitable environments for people to come in. And we have 40% of leadership is female within the company. I think that, you know, it's something that we pay attention to and work towards actively. But I also think that it's more about putting women in what I'm gonna call the green light rooms and in the green light meetings. You need to have more of females in the rooms where we're designing what games come to market so that it becomes a little bit more, you know, and it's not just, and let me be clear, I don't even think it's just women. It's just different voices in that room, diversity in the decision
making. I was going to ask that too, because it seems analogous to what we hear about Hollywood. It seems analogous to what we hear even across the board in venture capital, you know, more diversity and certainly more female voices. So
I'll also say that women can do, well, I think women being an entrepreneur can avoid a lot of the quote unquote kind of glass ceiling, whatever you want to call that, but that bias that you might experience, conscious or unconscious bias, you can actually avoid a lot of that by entering the room as an entrepreneur. I've had very successful meetings as an entrepreneur that I think that if I was trying to work my way up within an organization would have been much more difficult to have.
But I think you would agree that if you were getting started today in the workforce, it would be a more welcoming world by far. Yes. I was just at South By and yeah. It was amazing. I went into some venture meetings, I went to some entertainment, some metaverse, and I don't know, it could have been easily 50-50.
Yeah. I think that venture is still a rough road. I think that I experienced probably more difficulty in venture, like kind of raising money, especially as a female in the video game industry, trying to raise money was probably the most difficult time that I had in it. But I do think that, and I say this all the time to girls and women in the space, start with being really good at your job, start with being competent, and don't suck at your job first. Start there, you know, yeah, work hard and then deal with all the rest of it. Because at the end of the day, competence trumps. And, you know, men and everybody else in the room is going to be your biggest fan if you're reliable and you get everything done the way you said you were going to get it done. And so worry about being really competent and then worry about whether or not you're experiencing bias. Because I think it's easier to address the bias if you're really good at what you're doing.
No question. And then you get to learn all the other things. So
yeah.
So you would be a great mentor. I hope that you do create a few in your lineage of great CEOs there. It'll be a fun challenge. And maybe maybe as you get bigger with, I don't know what a Zordix is. You'll have to explain that to me.
But yeah.
Once you get into a bigger perch, you'll be able to expand in that way too, that diversity way we talk about.
Yeah. And I think that's what we're doing now with Maximum Games. I sold it to Zordix, became the CEO of that company, I think a month ago now. It's been about a month. Where that was announced. And now we really have a global stage for future video game development and launches of video games and creative content. Zordix is published public on the Swedish NASDAQ. We have offices in Sweden and in France and in, you know, multiple in the UK, multiple here in the US, Brazil. You know, we're kind of all over the world. And so it's really fun. The video game industry is really exciting because it's one of the true global entertainment industries. You know, movies and TV and other things, yes, they are global, but you can still feel where they're from.
Yeah, whereas they're like quite global. Yeah, you're being polite. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas like video games, you don't know where that video game was made. you know, most of the time. And so it's really a fun entertainment industry to be in, because you know that what you're creating is really going to go all over the world when it launches. And so it really can be diverse by nature, because you're getting, you know, these games are getting created from everywhere. So that's the next step, is really building Zordix, and we're always looking for more content, more games to develop, and taking advantage of all the new channels that there are to deliver video games. And
tell me something cool, Christina. What's happening in the world of VR, metaverse, 3D? Give me something excited to be looking forward to.
Yeah,
that might be a few months out or a year out or so.
Yeah, no, I'm bullish on VR.
Yeah,
I think that moving forward, we've resolved a lot of the things that were challenging in early VR about, you know, being nauseous and, you know, the tech not quite being there, and now it's good. And I think that's kind of the next real narrative experiences that you're going to be able to experience. I mean, think about if you're participating in something like a great narrative game, like a The Last of Us type of video game, but doing that in a VR world where you're really in the narrative of what's happening and making those choices, that's going to be an entirely different experience, which is really exciting. And I think that the tech is now at a place where and also from a cost standpoint to develop really good content on that, it can be done profitably, where I think before you really, you know, you could develop really good content, but it was so expensive that you weren't able to commercialize it in a way for a smaller company to be able to pull that off and be profitable. But now you can, because the tech is there and the development engines are there to do it. So I'm bullish on VR. I think it's really cool what we're going to be able to do.
Good. And when will we see, I know there's games out there already, but when are we going to see some?
Yeah, there's going to be stuff this year. We're a couple years out, but I think that it's going to be something that's going to change how people experience video games. And the other thing that I do think is that community in video games is going to continue to grow and become more and more exciting, as far as how we're interacting with each other within games and how we can maintain friendships. I mean, the pandemic was rough, right? Except the pandemic was great for video games. And because it was a way for people to really stay connected and build community in a way that that you couldn't do in person anymore during the pandemic. And I don't think that we're going back, right? I think that video games really became part of everybody's daily lives through the pandemic. And I don't see that changing. I mean, now this is how people are staying connected. And
they can go outside for a little bit, Christina.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I have three boys. And so I live with a lot of gaming in my world, both at home and in the office. And, but they really do stay connected with all of their friends, and everybody here stays connected with each other through gaming and through whether that's casual gaming or competitive gaming, whatever, it's really whatever you want to do. You can build a community around that.
So how much time do you let the kids play games on their?
So I do it opposite of that. It's not a limitation of how much time they can spend with games. It's, are you getting all of the other priorities in your life accomplished and done? Right. So it's more like try to spin it not as like a time limitation thing, but more of a balanced life prioritization thing. So
as much as we've talked about business, I know you're a super mom too, that are giving them the right perspective. It is another challenge to everything else. Can you have more challenge in your life? Three times, the business, trying to work with a company that's on the verge of, you know, on the borders with all the hell that's breaking loose over there.
And
I know it comes close probably because
one of our studios is in Hungary, which is on the border of Ukraine, and And it makes it all feel really real, you know, especially when you're talking to people who can physically hear helicopters.
Yeah.
It's really scary, and it changes your perspective on things, because it's not something that you're just reading about on the internet, but you're talking to humans that are literally having that daily impact in their lives. And so, lots of challenges, but you know, we're not here for everything to be easy. And so
no. But you're living a great life. You're doing some fantastic things. I told you I wouldn't take too much of your time. I've already gone over my limit with you. But
no, this was so fun. Thank you.
It's great catching up. And I want to wish you just tremendous success on all these fronts, because I love the potential of where things are going in the business for you. And what you could maybe do for that next generation of women executives, and then three boys, get out there and do some great stuff too, I'm sure.
Awesome. Well, it was really good catching up. Thanks for having me.
Nice catching up. We'll talk soon.
Okay.